The day is Sri Loka Shodas Babaji's appearance, but his appearance day. So yesterday we discussed about how bhakti leads to bhava. And we shared many things about devotional service in ecstasy. And today we talk about bhava grading into prema. So this is a very exalted topic that we can reflect on, and pray that one day that we can fully not only understand but enter into such states. So we'll preface it for 5 minutes with just some rather detailed clarifications about bhava, and then we'll go into discussion on prema. Bhava bhakti, the devotee focuses his mind with unwavering attention on the Supreme Lord. In sleeping, waking, dreaming, he always remembers Krishna. With incessant and intense desires to properly serve the Lord, the devotee in bhava discovers his original spiritual form. So in one sense, it's like the living entity has been amongst the living dead, like sleepwalker. Now they are finding interesting things about people who do things in their sleep. There are those who talk in their sleep. There are those who walk in their sleep. Even people who get up and eat something and move around and do things in the house. And they're asleep. Sleepwalking. Then in the Vedic scripture, we have these different levels of consciousness. Jagrat, the waking state. Swapana, sleeping state. Susipti, Susupti, the deep sleeping state. And Churya, the transcendental state. So these are all, the living entity is alive, different levels of consciousness, different levels of awareness. So many activities are going on in different ways. So really, it's as if in the material body, we're all asleep until we recognize our original Swarup. Until we're really able to understand the full nature of our eternality, in the different degrees, we're sleepwalkers, moving about, doing different things. So it's the highest aspect of bhava where one begins to wake up. And so the ecstasies, they burn away all of the remaining types of anarthas that were there. So different types of anarthas, they hang in, they linger on, all kind of doubts and fears and attachments to the duality. And then what happens is the ruchi, the taste, turns into the ashasti. And then what happens is that this steadiness then frees one from all of the anartha nivrittis, and then it just grades and grades more and more. There's more external absorption that then enhances the mental, I'm sorry, the verbal, and then we said the mental. And then gradually one begins to live more inside than outside. So now one is having the whole scheme of reality unfolding. And the external is just something like in the background. Almost like a nightmare until it fades away. Now his sentiments, his entire being yearns to be transformed. The bhava is of two kinds. First he says, ordinary people are unable to appreciate the value of riches, the experience, of course. The bhava of two kinds is of two kinds. Raga, bhakti, uta, springing from spontaneous devotional service, and Vaidhi Bhakta Uta, springing from regulated devotional service. So we think of these devotees like Goka Shodas, we see that their prema was not really on a platform of regulated devotional service, but it was just so much gushing out due to their unmotivated, interrupted love and attention, attachment to Krishna. In his different expressions. A devotee displays the first kind of bhava First kind of is spontaneous. A devotee pray the first kind of bhav, raga bhakti uta, denounces worship and awe and reverence because he shies away from any awareness of position. It means he has no interest so much in, you know, position, distinction, adoration, these sort of things. And even so much interest in scripture and ethics, what is called jati or pramana, or understanding, evaluating truth in different ways. One relates to the Lord more or less on equal terms, thus lending depth and weight to his particular bhav. You see, that's dangerous if one is not ready, if one has not clarified the consciousness sufficiently, then trying to relate to the Lord informally or on similar capacity of common level can just be another expression of trying to lord over and trying to be God rather than serve God. Second kind lacks the intensity of jati and pramana, or the second type, the spontaneous type. It lacks the intensity of the scriptural rules and regulations and the pramana, the ontological consideration of what, how to understand what is true. Therefore, bhava becomes influenced by the opulence of the Lord, thus reducing its weight and depth. Hence, these two varieties of bhava are relished by its two kinds of devotees, respectfully in their hearts, laden with transcendental desires to serve in two different ways. Now, of course, what happens later is this, the spiritual taste develops into the ras, full expression of the rasas. So just briefly, now we shall discuss the different ways of relishing that ras. Sweetness is present in different forms, in different foods, it explains. So there's five kinds which we are quite familiar with. Shanta ras, neutrality, dasha, servitude, sankhya, friendship, vatsalya, paternal, madhurya, conjugal. Bhava is just displayed as serenity when it's in santa bhakti, and affection in dasha bhakta, as kamaradi in shankhya bhakta, as filial love in vatsya bhakta, and as conjugal love in madhurya. So this love, this ecstasy, this bhava, it hasn't fully matured up to its highest height of frame, but now it is experienced in different mellows. And then these five kinds of rasas, according to their will, they modify themselves into which calls special types of ecstasies, vibhava, anubhava, vabhichari bhava, then stai bhava, the original king of bhava, stai bhava, all the other bhavas sort of surround the stai bhava. And so there's a great science of what these different bhavas, the mood, the expression, how they motivate the divine entity, how the divine entity serves Krishna in such ways, which we will not go into here. But it says, in other words, bhava becomes mortified, how do you pronounce it? The emphasis here is becomes personified, becomes fully manifested in the ras, where it is happening, it is flickering, it is in the background, it becomes more prominent. Now it becomes established fully in the ras exchange. Supreme Personality of God is the embodiment of ras, and the jivas exalt upon receiving it. Okay, now we jump into today's topic. This was just a carryover from yesterday. We didn't have a chance to finish. So there was so much we were discussing yesterday. So today we open up into the bhav leading into prema. Prema inspires the devotee's consciousness. Now remember that this is ultimately our most natural position. Everything else is becoming more and more same, becoming less affected by the amnesia. It's as if one has very chronic disease, and then gradually they're becoming a little freed of it, and they're becoming a little bit more stable, a little bit more balanced. And then finally, they fully gain their healthy original condition. And so, real, natural, healthy position, condition, is based on prema. The real natural position of every living entity is the total intoxication where one is totally in love, totally experiencing everything based on the highest expression of love, totally receiving Krishna's highest offering and association of love. So, Śrīla Viśvanātha Cakravārtī ends this Madhurya Kandambini by these discussions of prema. And we have another book that's included here, But it goes through these various 1, 2, 3, 4 to 8 showers of nectar. And so this 8th shower is what we'll discuss today, which really concludes this Marhuya Kandambini, or the clouds that's over the environment. And those clouds are showering the Marhuya, or the love, like the rain cloud, and it's dropping the rain, torrents of rain, and that rain is extinguishing the fire. So the fire is considered the blazing force fire of material consciousness, the material senses, got the whole body and mind on fire. Think about that. It's a huge fire. So really, the living entity situation in the material world, consider like their existence, their material existence, being on fire, the senses, demanding, the senses, agitating, and one is burning up in sense gratification in this day heat material body. And so this ecstasy, the bhav and frame, it just totally extinguishes and absorbs and then establishes, inaugurates a new time, which is the original time and experiences. So he says, alongside this blossoming of prema, marvelous changes occur. The devotee's consciousness previously entrapped by materialistic attachments for home and family is now inspired by praying to disdainfully discharge them and set itself free. The devotee has been identifying in so many lifetimes, a man and a woman, sometimes a man, sometimes a woman, sometimes a king, sometimes a queen, sometimes a devagod, demigod, sometimes apsara, sometimes a gandhara, sometimes even a rakshasa. But in each case, having some abode, having some arrangement, having some facilities, working some things out, looking ultimately for the frame, but looking in the wrong directions. Just as the touchstone jewel transforms ordinary objects to gems by touching them, by its potency, frame also miraculously transforms earthly attachments and makes them shine with sublime resplendence like its own self. Frame unfolds these attachments and bathes them in the nectar of the Supreme Lord's transcendental name, beauty, and qualities. And he goes on to explain the exaltation of a devotee. Well, first, the pure devotee begins to desire at every moment a direct audience with the Lord. We say we should never ask Krishna for anything. We should just ask how to serve. But the pure devotee at this level, he is asking and demanding and requiring and pleading and begging, even though feeling unqualified for the Lord's audience. But he's begging for that audience so that he can or she can serve the Lord in so many variegated ways. Begging for that audience as they're beginning to, as we read yesterday from the Bhav, that each sense is beginning to be excited as the senses are becoming alive after being dead for so many, many lifetimes. So they're becoming so excited as they are coming in touch with different aspects of the spiritual world and Krishna's association. So then one becomes mad. The burning arrow of extreme eagerness lacerates him. Its intensity causes him dissatisfaction despite his exaltation of the Supreme Lord's sublime beauty. The exaltation of a devotee experiencing prema is likened to a traveler where after painfully transversing the burning desert, it's like you have a traveler who's been in the desert sand, and or someone who's been starving or who has been dying of thirst. And so they're moving, they're going about, and they're desperate, and they're just wondering, they're having hallucinations, wondering, thinking this is water. They're getting flashbacks of the past. They're thinking of the future, thinking about their relationships and different things, thinking about what they could have done, what they did do, thinking of so many things, with such anxiety and anticipation for the food and for the drink. After painfully transversing the burning desert sand in the middle of summer, then he finds an oasis, cooled by a fresh stream, gurgling under the shade of a huge banyan tree. So, Vishwanath Chakravarti course is describing that the position of the living entity in the conditioned state is very much like this, a sleepwalker, dead person, who is basically more dead than alive. Now here's someone who is just about fully dead, and they're struggling, maintaining a little bit of life here, and now they come upon food, they come upon water. So he's describing that the intake of the prema is like that. The bliss of the prema is further likened to the happiness of a wild elephant feels after being trapped for days in a smothering forest fire and then suddenly drenched in torrential rains. So an elephant, big elephant, wild, crazed, and his fire is going on everywhere. He's trying to see how to get out. The heat is getting hot, more and more intense. Sometimes burning his body. He's struggling for his life. Then all of a sudden, this tremendous torrent of rain comes, and it just stops the fire. So, similarly, our body being on fire, so much sense gratification, vaya, fear, and kama, lust, and krodha, and mohan, and matsuya, and enviousness, intoxication, all of these things, you know, beating the mind, adiatmic, adidevic, adibotic, mental disturbances from one's own mind, and disturbances from others, disturbances from the devas, from the environment. So all of these things one has been subjected to in samsara. And all of a sudden, all this just gets thrown behind the past, as if one just walks out of one door into another environment where none of these things no longer are there to disturb the individual, to haunt the individual. And the person realizes, oh, what a relief to be freed from such. Like an elephant, or like a gourmet who after many days of sickness and being fed medicine and a bland, frugal diet becomes well and is now given a feast. We know that what it's like sometimes you're fasting for quite a while or you're sick and you have real austere diet. And then after a while you can be free from that diet and there's this big feast and you just dive into it. Of course, these descriptions only offer merely an idea of the devotee's state of joy because it cannot be compared to any material happiness. Material happiness and spiritual happiness are totally different from each other and by nature. So he's giving these just some way to get some example, some analogies. But he's saying that you really can't compare to any of these, but we can get some idea as we reflect on what it's like moving from one situation to the next where there's great desperation and now there's great fulfillment, satiation, and satisfaction. When the Lord reveals himself to the prema bhakta, when prema blossoms, the Lord reveals first, and so he gives now the stages of prema there and what type of experiences begin to take place initially. So first he says, the Lord reveals his form of matchless beauty to the enraptured devotee. So Krishna's appearing. The devotee's senses and mind become one, and he beholds with all his senses the Lord's exquisite beauty. So keep in mind how in the spiritual body, one sense can perform the activities of all the other senses. So here, the devotee is regaining his complete spiritual body. That is, he is viewing the Lord and praying, then it's like all of his senses just come together and converge as they are observing the Lord. So it's not just his eyes that's absorbing the Lord, even though it is the physical presence that's there, the spiritual presence. But all the senses are connecting with the eyes to behold the beauty, the form. The devotee's senses and mind become one, and he beholds of all of his senses the Lord's exquisite beauty. Says the mind also converges. And the sight of the Lord's unparalleled beauty, the devotee feels ecstatic symptoms, like being paralyzed, quivering, weeping, and so on. These ecstatic symptoms begin to hinder his vision of the Lord. Not only that, but the exhilaration renders him unconscious. So, all the senses converging, first as the Lord is showing, appearing. The devotee has had such joy and such grief. He has gone through the process. Or through great mercy, as we said, it is by effort and by mercy simultaneous. And so now, this devotee is being benedicted to be freed from all of his amnesia and all of these lackings and desires of the past, of now, convert into only wanting to be with the Lord and His associates. And so the Lord reciprocates. He sends a message through Krishna. And so, under the mercy of Srimati Radharani, who is the mother of devotion, so this soul has now been fully noticed. Or a better way to say it, this soul has fully noticed the Lord, because the Lord is already always there, trying to notice the divinity or being available. And so, first is the sight, is perception. But it's more than just perception of the eyes seeing, because all the senses, they also rush to make the connection. As all the senses rush, and the mind somehow, it also converges. And this is so overwhelming, with the contact, that the devotee goes unconscious. Seeing the devotee's condition, the Lord consolingly manifests His second ambrosial attribute. His physical fragrance, which emanates and which immediately arrests the devotee's sense of smell. Now, all the devotee's senses withdraw. We just read this, which I don't understand it. I don't understand it. We talk about it, we can try to reflect. So, all the devotee's senses. Now, seeing the devotee condition, the Lord is only to His physical fragrance, which immediately arrests the devotee's sense of smell. So now all the devotee's senses, they withdraw from the sense of sight. Remember, the mind, all the senses were now just seeing the Lord's beauty. Now they withdraw from the Lord, from the sense of sight, and they rush to the center of the sense of smell. So first the Lord is appearing, and so the devotee is gazing upon this magnificent form. And now the Lord is allowing from that form this ambrosial sensation of sense of smell. And now the devotee is unconscious, and that sense of smell revitalized the devotee, and all of his senses now go to the sense of smell. This overpowers him. And so even though this revives him, it overpowers him, and once again, in intense joy, it causes him to lose, become unconscious. Unbelievable. What is going on here? Who wants sense gratification when there's such opportunity? Krishna once again does what? He rescues the devotee. This is the third time, huh? And this time the Lord revives him with His melodious voice. The devotee has seen the Lord's form. All the senses rush there. And he goes unconscious. Then the Lord wakes him up with this ambrosial smelling coming from his body, from the sandalwood, from the flowers, from the etc. And so that sweetness revives the devotee just for all the senses to rush there in full consciousness, and then they become absorbed and experiencing more and more coming from the Lord. Then he goes unconscious again. Krishna once again rescues the devotee. And this time the Lord revives him with His melodious voice. So now, from the sight, from the smell, now Krishna is singing, Krishna is talking. And the Lord speaks to him, saying, "My dear devotee, I am your captive, fully under your control. Do not be overwhelmed. Just perceive me and fulfill the desire of your heart." Whew! The devotee's senses become surcharged, and they seek to hear and absorb the sweet melody of His beloved Lord's voice. So Krishna is seeing the state that the devotee is in as He is reviving him, and then He's giving his association in various ways. The devotee goes unconscious. And then He starts speaking to the devotee, explaining that, "I am actually your captive, fully under your control. I am your servant, or I am your das. Do not be overwhelmed. Just perceive and fulfill the desires of your heart." The devotee's senses become surcharged, and they seek to hear and to absorb the sweet melody of His beloved Lord's voice. Again, he is unable to contain his ecstasy, and he becomes bereft of consciousness. Just hearing the Lord saying that, "I am your servant. I am all yours. You have captured me. Just view me and fulfill all the desires of your heart." The devotee becomes totally unconscious as he is hearing such. Then the Lord, full of compassion, embraces the devotee with his body, displaying his fourth nectarine opulence of tender youthfulness. To the dasya devotee, and now as the Lord grabs and embraces the devotee, who has been unconscious four times, he revives him, and now he relates differently according to that devotee's core, of that devotee's heart desires. So to the dasya devotee, the mellow of servitudeship, he places his lotus feet on the devotee's head. To the Sankhya devotee, I'm sorry, the first is devotee in servitude. Second is the Sankhya devotee. Devotee in friendship, mellow friendship. What does he do? He entwines his lotus fingers with the devotee's fingers. To the Vatsya devotee in parental mellow, the Lord wipes away his tears of his lotus hand. The devotee who is in the mood of being the parent of the God, of Krishna. So for that devotee, he wipes away the tears. And to the Madhurya devotee, the devotee in conjugal love, he draws him to his chest and he wraps his arms around him in a tender embrace. From this we understand the Lord reciprocates appropriately the different mellows of each devotee's love. Just as before, when the devotee swoons in indescribable joy, the Lord shows his fifth opulence, that of versatile loving exchanges. Krishna offers the devotee sublime ambrosial in the form of true remnants from his mouth and lips. As the bhakti fully relishes it, his sense of taste becomes satiated. At this stage, the Lord appears to his devotee, who is now absorbed in the conjugal mellow, and he initiates him into a transcendental emotional exchange of intensely loving intimacy, long coveted by the devotee. Of course, the Lord never indulges such a confidential mood to any other devotee except one who is in Madhurya, the conjugal mellow. So we'll just go over that last section again. So after the fourth time, then Krishna again rescues the devotee, and this time the Lord revives him with his melodious voice. The Lord speaks to him saying, "My dear devotee, I am now your captive, fully under your control. Do not be overwhelmed, just perceive and fulfill the desires of your heart." The devotee's senses become surcharged and they seek to hear and absorb the sweet mellow of his beloved Lord's voice. Now you see why I'm reading this during Kartik Priya, so we can understand more about the goal that we are longing for. Again, he is unable to contain his ecstasy and he becomes bereft of consciousness. Then the Lord, full of compassion, now he embraces the devotee with his body. He displays his fourth nectarine opulence of tender youthfulness. To the dasya devotee, the mellow servitudeship, he places his lotus feet on his head. To the sankhya devotee, mellow of friendship, he entwines his lotus fingers with his fingers. To the vatsaya devotee, parental mellow, the Lord wipes away his tears of his lotus hands. To the Madhurya devotee, the conjugal mellow, he draws him to his chest, and he wraps his arms around him in a tender embrace. So we see that no expression of mellow is being left out, according to however that entity eternally wants to be with the Lord. The Lord is receiving him or her as one is now revitalizing their full consciousness, and Krishna is inaugurating them into what they will be doing with him eternally. From this we understand the Lord reciprocates appropriately with the different mellows of each devotee's love. Just before, when the devotee swoons in indescribable joy, the Lord shows his last opulence in this full revitalization of the devotee. or recitation, resuscitation, like somebody's dying, you resuscitate them. His fifth opulent, a versatile love exchanges, Krishna offers the devotee the sublime ambrosio in the form of chewed remnants from his own mouth and lips, and the bhakta fully relishes it. His sense of taste becomes satiated. At this stage, the Lord appears to his devotee, who is now absorbed in the conjugal mellow, and he initiates him into a transcendental emotional exchange of intense loving intimacy. Once again, the devotee is drawn into an overwhelming mood of divine bliss from this intimate encounter with the Lord, and again he swoons. The Lord's succor, anyone know what that means? S-U-C-C-O-R. Like relish. The Lord's succor to him this time is the form of showers of what's called in Sanskrit odarya, or magnanimity, generosity. His sixth transcendental attribute. In this condition, the devotee will not respond to any consoling. The odarya in this instance means when all the transcendental attributes of the Lord are at one time forced onto the devotee's conglomerate senses. Sight, hearing, mind, etc. Prema now responds almost as if to the Lord's bidding. It waxes by leaps and bounds, and the devotee's thrust for it increases proportionately. Gradually, like the waxing moon, these transcendental attributes combine together to mature fully. Uncountably like the waves in the ocean of unlimited bliss. The transcendental pastimes help Prema to stir and shatter the devotee's heart. Prema then installs itself in the devotee's mind as its guardian deity, repairing and rebuilding its inner being. Prema radiates its energy, the Adarya, in such a way that the devotee is able to relish unhindered all the Lord's transcendental qualities. So what does this mean? It's first they're coming, the different senses, and the Lord is reciprocating, and the devotee is overwhelmed, and then the Lord revives, and the devotee is overwhelmed, and then the Lord revives, overwhelmed, and then the Lord embraces. And then the Lord involves in the devotee in transcendental activities. Now, the Lord is giving this intense mercy where all of these things are no longer just coming in flashes. They're no longer just coming one thing after another. But now they are like installed within the devotee's full existence or full consciousness. In other words, now all of this is always going on at the same time, eternally. Thus it cannot be refuted that the devotee can taste to his complete satisfaction, all different qualities of the Lord. Seeing the devotee's predicament, the Lord thinks, is this confusing? The pure devotee is eager to relish altogether each of the Lord's sublime attributes, just as his exquisite beauty. But just as a swallow with its beak shut tight, is unable to slight its thirst even when it rains. So the devotee is also helpless on his own against the Lord's opulences, which is inundating his senses. In other words, the devotee is so happy, is so absorbed, is so intense, his call coming at the same time, and it's overwhelming for him. It's just overwhelming. Seeing the devotee's predicament, the Lord thinks, is this confusion the purpose of my matchless beauty? So the Lord offers to the devotee his seven opulence. Goes on and on. His opulence of compassion. This opulence is the headmistress of all other attributes. It is she who is enthroned in the corolla of the eight-petal lotus, constituting the eighth potency, and it goes on. Now, the Lord's compassion is the crown jewel of his attributes. So Krishna has given himself fully, and the devotee is experiencing this overwhelming position. And Krishna is seeing that this is due to the intense love that they are sharing. So now Krishna is making additional arrangements for this devotee's eternal existence of relishing the mellows. The seventh opulence of the Lord is also known as anugraha, or mercy. She manifests herself, notice, not saying she manifests herself in the Lord's lotus eyes in a varied splendor. So the Dasya Bhakta, so now Vishwanath is explaining how this level now of compassion is given and how it's experienced in different rasas. To the Dasya Bhakta, she is compassion. To the Vatsalya Bhakta, she is filial fondness. To the Madhurya Bhakta, she is heart-melting magnetic power. In this way, she appears in many forms, matching the different loving moods of the devotees. This mentions about 18 faults. The scripture have identified 18 human shortcomings that go against its tenets. They are follows. Okay, then there's more in that, but we'll move to the actual conclusion of this. It's beyond understanding, so my reading it'll interfere. I can't read it and understand it. The scriptures have identified 18 human shortcomings that go against its tenets. They are as follows: illusion, sleepiness, uncivility, lust, greed, madness, envy. In other words, all of these things are the things that has checked the identity from all these experiences that are available. And so if we throw those things out, quick, fast, then we have a chance to be freed of the amnesia. And this is why Vishwanath built up explaining about those things previously, what these enemies are of the mind, the distractions, the anarthas, different types of anarthas, and what they do, how they stagnate. Illusion, sleepiness, uncivility, lust, greed, madness, envy, cruelty, lamentations, over-endeavor, deceitfulness, anger, desire, fear, mistake, intolerance, and dependence. The scripture proclaim that the Lord's qualities are absolutely free from these discrepancies. So the more that devotee becomes dependent upon Krishna, dependent upon guru and sadhu and shastra, then where it would seem, normally people are thinking, the more they're independent and do whatever they want, when they want, how they want, they think the more they're going to be happy. But it's the opposite. It's the more they keep on putting themselves in anxieties and frustrations, and they keep going on with the envy and the lust and the greed and the fear and the doubts and all of these things, and that just maintains the dehi, the physical body, and all of its bombardments and anxieties, and ultimately so much sickness and death. But as we release ourselves, and as we surrender, accepting what Krishna is summoning, but these other things are blocking, so once those blocks are removed, what's there? And so this is why devotional service is so much based on this intensity of taking shelter, of humility and simplicity and surrendering and unmotivated, unconditional service. Because it's really based upon how to get everything. By what? How to get everything? By giving up everything. If we give up everything, then we're actually available to receive everything. The Supreme Lord acknowledges, but living entity is thinking, no, I got to have this. Or they're thinking, Krishna, you want me to give up everything, all right, but first you give. But the onus is on us. We have been the criminals. So it's like a person in jail, and they say, well, let me out and you'll see I'll be better. You let me out and you'll see. I'm going to be okay. Let me out. But the onus is on them. They have been acting improper. Now they're in prison. And so it's on them to show that they're different now so they can be free. It's not on the warden, to let them out with the hopes that they're going to change because they've had this bad experience. No, they have to act now proper, which shows that they can be okay when they're out. So we don't go back without acting now as we eternally are in the spiritual world. So we have to become like that now. And then it shows that we're ready to be free from these shackles. It's not that you leave the body and all of a sudden you go back to the spiritual world by some undue mercy. That you become like that. One has physicality, is there, absorbing the senses in the mind. I'm sorry, the senses in the body. And then there's more of the verbal, speaking about such things. And then there is the mental reflection. Then the mental, they settle in and become stronger and stronger, more and more mature. And then the mental begins to become the all. And the other things are in the background. But now, in most of our cases, if our body is not being so much absorbed in the spiritual associations, and if the speaking is so much mundane, and then the mind is all about, aham, amiti, I want this, I do this, I get this on myself. I stop this because inconvenience is what I want. I don't do this thing. I don't like that. I don't like this. Then it means that that's the mental stuff. And that is not producing the unconditional, unmotivated, loving body that Krishna is ready to associate fully with. But it's producing more and more of the physical body that engages in being attacked by the enemies of the mind. When the other case, the mind has become not a best friend. Because the meditation is all about the spiritual. So now the mind is the best friend. The mind is like the key opening up the door to the spiritual realm. Where previously, the mind is like the lock that's got everything shut down. So mind can be your lock. It can shut down and keep you incarcerated. And then having to experience all the things of the incarceration of the mind can be like the key that opens that lock and lets you walk right out of the physical body or physicality into the spiritual realm, even before one physically leaves the physical body. Supreme Lord acknowledges his devotee's feelings, and he says to him, "My dear devotee, you have sacrificed wife, children, wealth, and home countless times in many births. You have tolerated such sufferings as that ravages of scorching summers, freezing winters, hunger, thirst, pain, and disease, only so you could serve me as I had asked you to do. You have disregarded a million humiliations from others and maintained your life by begging. Yet so far I have been unable to reciprocate with you. Now offering you anything, not offering you anything, this makes me indebted to you. Now tell me, what can I offer you? Lordship of this entire universe, the position of Lord Brahma, all the mystic opulences, and so on are not befitting. Hence, how can I offer them to you? It is becoming of a gentleman to offer grass, straw, and other animal fodder to a human being. Considering all of this, I offer myself to you. Although I am unconquerable and indomitable, I am won over by you." So here Krishna is speaking himself to the living entity. And he's saying how, "I know what sacrifices you've made for me." And he says, "Lifetime after lifetime. My dear devotee, you have sacrificed wife, children, wealth, home, countless times in many births. You have tolerated such sufferings as that ravages of scorching summers, freezing winters, hunger, thirst, pain, and disease, only so you could serve me." In other words, one who are not ready to do this, then Krishna is not speaking this way, because these are the qualifications that are necessary. Where one is all for Krishna. So whatever one has, they offer it to Krishna. And so Krishna is saying, "So you have done this for me. Because you have done this, this is why you come to this level where you can receive me in full, because after all, you have given everything to me. You have tolerated such." Krishna says, "You did this several lifetimes and I was watching. You've done this, and now because you've done all of this, I can't repay you. What can I repay you with? Give you position of Lord Brahma is not enough. Give you position of Lord Shiva is not enough. Give you position or Devagan is not enough. Give you the Lord over universes." He says, "No, this is not sufficient. Give you mystical opulences." He says, no. "What is that? This is belittling. To think that all that you have done, maintained lifetime after lifetime, this is all I'm going to give you." So then he says, "Well, I have to give you myself. Considering all of this, I offer myself to you. Although I'm unconquerable and indomitable, I am won over by you. I am your property. I shall simply depend on your gentle disposition." The Lord's ambrosial words enter the devotee's ears like pearl drops of nectar. The devotee replies, "My dear Lord, O Supreme Person, you are an ocean of mercy. Seeing me swept away by the swift currents of gross materialism and becoming the helpless prey of the cruel, venomous snake of time, you took pity on me. Your petal-soft heart melted and to remove my lust and essence, you appear before me as the most perfect spiritual preceptor. Your appearance is awe-inspiring, like the powerful presence of the Sudarshan chakra is to its natural enemies, and thus rescue me from the horrendous poison fangs and grim black coat of the snake of time. So now the devotee is speaking. And here this competition is going on, where Krishna is trying to offer everything to the devotee. And the devotee is saying, oh, you are just so merciful. How I was in those conditions, and you appeared to me as a spiritual master, and you guided me in such ways. Your intention was to elevate me to become your maidservant, so I can serve your divine lotus feet. And so you have made yourself available in the form of the most purifying of syllables, your pure eternal associates, and taught me the process rendered to you. I am so flagitious, I don't know what that word means, and fallen that I do not serve you even for a moment. I am fit to be severely rebuked for this atrocious act. Yet, the devotee said, you were there in all these different ways, and I didn't fully take advantage of it, or I didn't fully appreciate it. And so I deserve to be rebuked, rather than you feeling pity that I had to struggle all of this way. Yet you spared me, and instead you made my eyes drink the most sublime vision, that of your beautiful face, and still you say that you are indebted to me. These words spoken by my beloved Lord have deeply disturbed me. At this juncture, I'm thinking about my next course of action, to ask to be pardoned for the sins of a few lifetimes. Nay, a million lifetimes would be audacious on my part. In fact, I feel my wicked offenses, number one, trillions that have been accumulating since time immemorable. I have already suffered some of these consequences. What is left? Let me face them, for I refuse to beg for them to be absolved. The devotee is such a latest level of humility. Even now that they have attained this height, they're feeling unworthy, and then this loving exchange is going on, the verbal exchange, etc. These words of endless remorse and lamentation flow freely from the devotee. This pleases the Lord immensely. The Lord reciprocates with the prayasi mood, the mood of a stricken beloved for her lover, which then elevates devotees. He fulfills their yearnings. He immediately manifests what? Vrindavan, the land immortalized for a stage in his transcendental pastime. So when all this is going on, of the unconscious expression, all this that is happening, Krishna giving, in one sense, of the devotees converging to all the senses, experiencing something, Krishna reviving, Krishna then offering a betel nut, then Krishna feeling how this devotee has suffered, the devotee expressing, no, it's not that I have suffered, I only have suffered that I have been so stubborn, that you were there for me in so many ways. Krishna is saying, and feeling so exhilarated by the love that the devotee is maintaining and having toward him. Then Krishna, out of his, again, higher level of compassion, then he manifests Vrindavan for this living entity. There the devotee sees Krishna with his most beloved gopis, Srimati Radharani, daughter of King Vrishabhanu, this Mahayoga Pita, and then there's so many things the devotee is witnessing that's going on in that eternal realm. Now, we end with this aspect, the symptoms of prema. Thereafter, the devotee becomes more or less aware of himself and his immediate surroundings. His eyes flutter open, and finding that his beloved Lord is nowhere to be seen, he begins to pine for him. Unrestrained tears pour down his cheeks in streams. Remember, this devotee is still in the physical body. He ponders, was I in a dream? No. If it were so, see, here it shows it's not pie in the sky. It's not that you wait to go back to the spiritual world and then all these things happen and you realize, well, maybe it's not, no, I see it's true. But this is what's happened. And this devotee has reached perfection. And so Krishna has taken him through all of these stages and has introduced him to his original form, introduced him to these two of Vrindavan, and how he fits into all of these things that's going on. And so now the boy has had all of these experiences in the state of absorption, of ecstasy, of bhava, praying, of trance. And so now the devotee is thinking, in reflection, he's trying to think about it. He says, was I in a dream? Then he says, no. If it were so, I would still be drowsy. My eyes would be sticky from sleep. Then was it all created by some mystic powers? That is not also plausible, because the bliss I experience is not an illusion or something mundane. In other words, he realizes this bliss he's never experienced before, and that is not just something that could just be of some imagination. Maybe it was hallucination, an error of the mind. This is also not true. Otherwise, I would feel restless and my heart empty. So because this has happened to the devotee is feeling totally fulfilled. So he's thinking, well, it can't just be hallucination or imagination, because then I wouldn't be still feeling this total absorption in such a way. Complete satisfaction. Could it be a fabrication of a fertile imagination? No. This experience is beyond the capacity of any imagination. The devotee said, I cannot imagine all of these things. For all my highest level of creativity, I couldn't imagine the kind of things that the Lord would do to one or associate with one. This cannot be imagination. The other possibility is that the Lord's vision may suddenly appear in my mind's eye because of extreme happiness. This is also ruled out, because of every previous occasion when I saw the Lord, I can't remember what they were like. But my present experience is far more unique. So this devotee was having some previous glimpses on the state of bhava, ecstasy, and some shadow, some things were there. But he's saying, but this one was far greater than that. And so it could not just be some hallucination, some imagination, some reflection. No. In this way, the devotee, assailed by doubts, falls to the ground, rolling in the dust. At times he reverts to constant entreating the Lord to show himself again. So he's had this and he's still kind of wondering and reflecting back. So then he's thinking, well, just show yourself again. When the Lord does not appear, he is grief-stricken and he renews rolling on the ground so vigorously that he causes pain to his body. Finally, the devotee loses consciousness and goes into a static coma. Sometime later, he awakes, jumps up, sits down, weeps incessantly, wailing in a loud voice like a madman. Then suddenly, the devotee stops all activity and retreats into a grave silence. On other occasions, the afflicted devotee simply neglects all his regular religious and other duties, behaving whimsically and loosely. Again, for no apparent reason, he begins to speak incoherently like a lunatic. The devotee friend approaches him with good intention to pacify him and to make confidential inquiries about his condition. The devotee immediately reveals to his friend everything he has experienced. His friend tries to reason with him, saying, "My friend, your immense good fortune has enabled you to directly meet the Supreme Lord." For a while, he becomes calm and composed. Glowing with profound happiness, he says, "But alas, shall I ever behold again his exquisite face?" And the next moment he is plunged into deep despondency and he cries out, "How unfortunate I am! By the grace of a highly enlightened and pure devotee of the Lord, I was able to see the Lord's divine and beautiful form. But a mountain of misfortune obstructed me from performing even the slightest devotional service to the Lord. The sudden appearance of the Lord before me was certainly due to some incalculable heaps of piety. But because of my immeasurable grieving offenses, he has now lost my vision." So the devotee is thinking that Lord appeared and I didn't serve him. He's thinking, I had all of this happening to me, but I didn't do any service to him. And then he's thinking, it is due to my grievous offenses from so many lifetimes that now the Lord has disappeared. Constantly maintaining this sense of humility, unworthiness, and that is shown the devotee's qualification for being able to receive, because he is totally, fully surrendered, having given everything, therefore he's experiencing everything. On the bereft devotee thinks, "Krishna is so merciful that he awarded me his direct audience. Although I am an insignificant speck floating in an ocean of bad qualities, this is because his mercy is causeless, hence he appeared to me. It's because of some unimaginable good fortune that the boundless ocean was for a moment in the palm of my hand. But alas, my terrible faults have made this ocean disappear. My ignorance prevents me from discovering what actually happened. The whole experience has dumbfounded me and turned me into a fool. Where can I go? What shall I do? To whom shall I turn to for the answers? I feel the world empty and void, absent of any companions, friends, or dear ones, a planet without a sanctuary, a whirl of flame and a raging forest fire to devour me. Under these circumstances, let me go to a secluded place away from crowds so I can meditate on this subject for some time. But even a quiet retreat does not bring him tranquility. He calls out to the Lord, "Oh, my Supreme Master, my beautiful Lord, your face is like the blossoming lotus. O reservoir of divine nectar, all of Vrindavan is intoxicated and aroused by the fragrance of your transcendental body. The swaying garland of wildflowers around your neck is attracting the honeybees and making them restlessly buzz around. How can I again have a moment's glimpse of your charming face? Only once have I relished the nectar of your sublime beauty. Will it be possible for me to again taste that delectable ambrosial? I humbly beg you to reveal yourself to me." In this way, the devotee laments, sighing and sometimes rolling in the dust. At times he collapses in ecstasy, a static state of unconsciousness, or he suddenly runs hither and there like a madman. He sees Krishna in every direction and exuberantly laughs, sings, cries, dances simultaneously. But in the very moment, he breaks down, and then he cries hot tears of remorse. The devotee can thus pass the rest of his life in pursuit of such transcendental symptoms of ecstasy, but never more does he pamper his body. In other words, he is unconcerned about his physical well-being, feeling it unnecessary to inquire into his needs. After the demise of his body, the devotee attains the eternal spiritual form, the Siddhadehi, and he engages in the Lord's service. Factually, the devotee understands he has reached that Siddhadeha stage when he becomes oblivious to his physical body. He's still in the body. He's had so many problems in the past, but now he realizes that he is a spiritual being. He's had the spiritual connection. He's had the taste. He thus thinks, "The Supreme Lord, who is an ocean of compassion, has appeared on my plea, and he will personally engage me in his direct service and take me to his eternal abode." With this understanding, the devotee feels crowned with success. So he goes on in the rest of the existence in that physical body, acting somewhat like a mad person, because he no longer has any taste for material existence. He no longer has any doubts about the illusions of material involvements. He's completely feeling overwhelmed of how the Lord has been watching, has been providing, Guru, the holy name, Sadhu Association, Shastra. He's totally amazed at how all of his senses converged and received reciprocation with the Lord. Totally amazed at how the Lord is so much ready to give him everything and felt that nothing can be of enough glory and appreciation. So the Lord gives him himself fully. And therefore, he is spending the rest of the time in his existence, basically in and out of trance, as he is just waiting to put aside that physical garment, which is now his identity is fully established, and he is just waiting when he can eternally be able to do and to experience what the Lord has let him know is waiting there for him, which he is gradually inviting him back and back and back. Whew! Hare Krishna! So, any questions? Yes. Who wants to hang around in material body? Anyway, we use the body and give it to Krishna, and then it becomes spiritual.
I don't have a question, it's just a comment. As you were talking about the experiences that the devotee had in meeting Krishna, the convergence of the senses, and just passing out again. In the story, in the Krishna book, came to mind about the gopis when they heard Krishna's flute in the night, and of course some of the gopis are married, and they left their activities, and they wanted to go to the to meet him in Vrindavan, the forest. And particularly those gopis who were not given a chance to go, were stopped by the husband, that they left their bodies. For the first time, it hit me how they would leave their bodies in a situation like that. If a devotee in a physical body can just pass out, just meeting the Lord this way, just connecting those two.
Yes, what it shows is that their loyalty, their greed was so intense that they refused not to associate. If they could not associate with their physical bodies, then they went anyway. And so their passing out like that was that they went, you know, to be in the association. You can see the power also of hearing in the right environments. Because by hearing, it stimulates the desire for experience, for association. And so Krishna is responding to every living entity's desires. So an issue is how to desire for the right thing with the right level of intensity. And so this only happens from proper association. And so as we are sharing this, it's like we're getting a little chance to associate with Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur. And so as we are hearing such things, then it literally has its way of transforming consciousness. It's like this last hour we're reading this, we have dropped certain karmic patterns just by hearing this. So there's been acceleration in one's devotion just by hearing these sort of things. This is what we are reading. And different devotees experiencing it and reflect on this in different ways. So this is internal cleansing that's going on by itself. And this is why the Sadhu Sangha Association and Quality Association is so important. But it also helps us to see things we need to work on. As when all this is discussing all of these things, then he comes right back and starts talking about the 18 things we have to be careful about. Envy and greed and fear and attachments and so many things. So he's letting us know, okay, this is what Krishna is offering. But what do you want? You want to hang on to this stuff? Or do you want what Krishna is making available? Unbelievable.
Mm-hmm. Listen to you and formulate my question at the same time. It's a little difficult. But obviously the degree of surrender which is necessary to come to this high stage of devotional service is a very difficult thing to come to. Say, in our movement, there's impurities and there's difficulties, and they seem to be surfacing at a particular degree and level at right now. So to come to this level of surrender, there has to be trust and faith in authorities. Obviously, gurus falling down could be a great difficulty. But at the same time, there is an individual. Some of the responsibility would fall on the individual as well to come to this level. The two things would certainly be related, the individual desire, but then also coming from the authority. I don't know if this is actually a question or what.
No, it's a deep reflection and question. I follow you fully. Yes, so, and this is the whole science of bhakti, sort of wrapped up in your question, that living entity is a, you know, in the individualized expression of Krishna, has her or his own free will, And Krishna is tuning in to them. But at the same time, we are products of different levels of socialization. Past lives, as we were discussing earlier, present. And we are highly influenced by the quality of association that we have. The quality of connection, of alignment. So, just as a student is distinctly influenced by the quality of the teacher. Just like, we see in the schools. So students, or at the parents. So a student is going to be affected by how the parent is encouraging the child, as well as how the children are being learning in the school, and how they are learning from each other. One of the dangers homeschooling the child only, the child also grows from so much exchanges with other children. And so that's needed, but it's needed to have quality at the same time. And so all of those things, it makes up the character. So now when we have an institution where the gurus who are to act as some of the major instructors, if they're falling down, or we have an institution where teachers who are acting as the main guides for the academic and spiritual education are leaving the jobs or abusing the kids or not being sensitive or taking it, you see, lightly, then what happens? Then it means that individual soul, the experiences and the level of intense desire and greed is going to be affected by that. Because those things are going to bring doubts and whatnot if the environment has not been sufficiently encouraging, or some of those who are to be acting as a catalyst for fanning the love are not doing it properly. However, still, in spite of that, Krishna will be noticing the individual. But the difficulty is that individual is kind of karmically also connected with the environment, and in most cases is going to lock into what the environment is.
Okay. How can one protect oneself, but at the same time surrender?
Well, Krishna knows. He's in the heart. So Krishna knows to what degree we genuinely want to come to Him and at what pace. And so, and this is what we really have to always keep in mind, that whatever is going on is really about the living entity in Krishna. And so Krishna has arranged all kinds of fields of activities. But ultimately, that living entity that is serious, Krishna is going to keep bringing them through. Keep bringing them through. And even some of the most difficult experiences are going to act as a catalyst literally to help that individual. Because that person is so much wanting Krishna that Krishna is going to arrange that even the most things that are seemingly stagnating is going to have the opposite effect. It's going to intensify that entity's desire for the truth, for the love, for the association. So we really have to see more and more that a lot of things are going on and will always go on, but it's always been and always will be come down to Krishna and His part and parcels. And Krishna is going to be the one who's going to remove this or arrange this or bring us through based on our genuine desire to surrender. But we don't just leave it like that, because we have to accept the fact that we all have a duty to try to create an environment that makes it easier for ourselves and everyone to accelerate. But ultimately, Krishna is going to respond in every single case according to the genuine desire and quality of surrender. And that can be, one can be, a child grows up, for instance, with one parent or two parents, or with karmic family, or with devotee family, or in this situation, that situation. But in general, we are more or less influenced by heredity and environment. But in spite of all of that, Krishna is there and is responding to the quality of the entity.
Ultimately, if things go wrong in our devotional service, and so many times they do, and we've seen gurus fall down and so many people leave, but we really have no one to blame it's our own means. Like we can't say, well, this person did that, it's therefore.
Yeah, because they really don't fall down so much in one sense. What happens is that they get exposed at what level of devotion they really are having. And so one may pretend to have a certain level of devotion. So as you go on and on and on, then Maya has a duty to reveal. This is where you're at. 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 Now, what are you going to do based on that? Does that make any sense? In other words, the material body and the material world is basically a place for deviation. And so Krishna is constantly arranging to see how much one wants to get out of that deviation. And so when somebody falls, what it really means is that they have advanced to a certain level, and now they have inwardly decided that they don't want to go any closer. So Krishna arranges to put them a little to the side like this. But whatever they require is what they have for the next round, later in this life or in the next lifetime. So really, people are not so much deviating. We would say that. But what's really happening is that individuals are being categorized. But the sad part is when you're in a leadership position, as you are categorized and you don't make the mark, you affect all of those who are under you. Because they are so much karmically, psychically locked up in your consciousness. But then, well, not to sound harsh, but at the same time, that is also arranged by Krishna. The fact that one is under this kind of alignment and this kind of thing happens in general, that is also arranged by Krishna. Based on all the different players, karma, desires, etc. Yes?
Those devotees are sincere, those souls are sincere, they'll go on.
They're always going. Yes. Even if there's a little setback, that setback will be processed in such a way that now, when they're on track again, the leap, it jumps. Like that. Sometimes we explain how our advance in the spiritual life is really not so vertical. Sometimes it's vertical because from past lives. But we come, and then we work some things out, and then we grow, we work some things out. So some of these things are needed, for lack of a better word, stagnations or tests for us to see what we are now able to do as we process and work out, and then we go on. You know. So even for that person who gets categorized, that is not necessarily, in an esoteric sense, it's not necessarily a fall, although it is a fall, but it's really a clarification where Krishna is now helping the person to see what things they're really having, what they're not having. So now the person can look at all of this and deal with all of this and start trying to work at what they don't have and begin to grow. You see. Krishna gives us much more than our quality. And then he gives us a chance to come up to that quality. I mean, to come up to it. So it's like he gives you something, and then now he gives you a chance to really come up to it. If you don't come up to it, then you get kind of categorized at a certain level within that. See, the mercy is always greater than the law and other things. So you're being given. And now the thing is, are you really going to come up and become that now? Or to what level will you come close? And then more work is there in this life or the next life. So similarly, for instance, Srila Prabhupada has all these disciples, thousands of disciples all around the world. And on most part, majority are in different places and they're processing things, and some are a little stagnant and some are very stagnant. But they're still connected with Prabhupada. And as they have passed a certain lesson, passed some, failed some, so now Prabhupada has responsibility to see that they get additional help, support to move on, to move on, to move on, etc. And so what we see now in the movement, so many fall downs and so much deviation, and there is disturbance with the cows, and there are disturbances with the children, care of the kids, care of the cows, it's care of the widows, there's disturbance with the care of the Brahmins, all of these things. It actually has to be there. Because it's really clarifying what the realities are. So now people can work on it if they want. If they don't, then they get preoccupied just in the revelation of the duality, and then that duality becomes their sadhana. Or the anxieties and pain become their sadhana. Rather than realizing, wow, we were really given this that was like so high. And we're given the chance to become that. How wonderful. But Prabhupada arranged. Now, let's do what we can. Many of us as possible to come up to that. And that's where the real question is. How much will we come together as an international organization, recognizing this wonderful high thing we were given, how low our position was in terms of Prabhupada reaching down so much to get us, now how much will we collectively, lovingly struggle and try to come up to that, or how many people will find ways to scapegoat without working on the real issues, or how much they will blame others, or how much they will let their pain cause them not to walk up, see to catch up. And this is what kind of is happening now. Our movement as well as the world is going through so much of the processing now. And some people will sideline or sidetrack. And others, this will cause them to get more motivated to move toward these goals. It'll make them less attached to any of the duality as they see the harshness of the duality. See, one can take any difficulties they've had and they can use that to think how much they don't want to be a part of that duality anymore. Or one can use it in the sense of feeling victimized and feeling inferior and just make a mantra. And the nourishment now of the sadhana just becomes the prajapa, it becomes the anxiety, and then it turns into the anger and frustration and cynicism. So some people, their diet now is cynicism. Like anything they write, anything they talk about, it's all cynicism. You come around and all you do is cynicism. No, that can't work. No, this happened. That happened. Have you heard about this? And this is their whole mantra. So they don't realize how much they're stagnating themselves. And then others are thinking, oh, so how do we avoid being an embarrassment to Prabhupada? How do we reach out for each other? How do we learn from this situation so it doesn't happen again? And so there's an amazing demarcation that's happening in the movement. And I see it a lot when I travel. I see that devotees are either getting very weak or a few are becoming very intense. But in most cases, the distractions are overwhelming. And in the process, people, they lose it. And even some of those who are still strictly studying the scriptures, they often study the scriptures just so they can beat somebody over the head with it. You know, they can attack this group of thinking like this, attack the Ritviks, or attack the Narayana Maharaj people, or attack the Puri Maharaj people. Or it can attack like this, like that, or use it to show that gurus are useless, use it to show the institutions are useless. And so all this now becomes like warfare. And in warfare, with Vaishnavas, means aparads. At the end of the day, each person engaged in the aparads actually suffers from it. And then Prabhupada's, you know, mission gets somewhat stagnated or procrastinated. It doesn't get stopped, but then it hurts to the general mission. And this is why we can see Krishna took Prabhupada away, which is no accident, because we had to go through these things. It's like, you know, you have the child and you are trying to wean the child off the breast, or you're trying to get the kid to learn how to, you know, to ride the bicycle without the trainer wheels. You kind of have to put them in a sort of a difficult situation, or you sort of refrain as you're really trying to help them to mature. So when the child was on the trainer wheels, the child was moving all around, they were going fast, and they thought they were doing it all themselves. And then you take the wheels and they start falling down. But then gradually, they start moving. So Prabhupada was making so many things happen as we were on the training wheels. And then we're moving fast. And now we have to be able to move. So you're taking the wheels, you know. And so in that, a lot of fall downs, a lot of things. Some people decide to, you know, put the whole bike away. It doesn't work anymore. You know, some people blame the bike. They kick it. It never was any good, you know. They get mad at somebody else, you know. Whose bike is going. So all of these things. But it's really what has to happen for that child to really be able to, you know, ride on the bike themselves. So what looks like a lot of confusion is also has a lot to do with maturation. Sure. So why don't we just end the class now? Then the devotees can get to advance. This is very intense to reflect on. And it's nice also, give me a question, one of the questions, how we bring it to, you know, our present situation. And this must be constantly done as we hear the philosophy and as we reflect on things. And we should constantly also make it relevant to our day-to-day experiences. Otherwise, we won't be able to work on some of these issues that we're having to deal with in our society. And that's another weakness that we're having internationally. And sometimes we're reading, having the Bhagavatam class, the Gita classes, we're having institutions, the institute programs, the IHE. But then we have to carry that with us in our day-to-day activities, and we have to carry it in our mind and looking at the particular issues that we're dealing with so that we can see how to bring, you know, these spiritual technologies to make a difference in such a way. ISKCON found the charge is divine with AC Bhakti Vedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada ki. Sri Radha Dama Rabala Kala Sanjagana Bala Dei Subhadra ki.